Brian Platzer is the author of the highly acclaimed debut novel Bed-Stuy is Burning. His latest is The Body Politic. The novel follows four friends, Tess, Tazio, David, and Angelica, as they grapple with love, commitment, and compassion in the years following 9/11 and the 2016 election. With the novel, Platzer explores forgiveness, duplicity, and our current political moment, as well as a chronic illness similar to the one that derailed his own life. Again, the name of the book is The Body Politic. Brian Platzer is the author, and it's a great pleasure to welcome him back to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us.
So thrilled to be back. I so enjoyed our last conversation and have been looking forward to this one.
I look forward to talking about this new book as well. What brought it, I can assume what brought it to be, but what was it that you wanted to explore and to put it on your radar?
So for 2.5 years after the publication of my first novel, I was debilitatedly, chronically ill. I was dizzy all day, every day, from the time I woke up to the time I went to sleep. I couldn't see right. I couldn't think. I was sort of discombobulated, couldn't work or teach or be alone with my children. I lost life entirely. And over the course of a few years, I found my way back to the correct medication, so I get a few hours of clarity every day. And then once I could start writing again, all I wanted to do was try to figure out those years that I lost. I wanted to think through the emotions and the vulnerabilities and that horror of having an invisible illness myself. And from there, I wanted to think through the experience of my wife and my family and colleagues and coworkers who all sort of helped as much as they could and you know, took that ride along with me.
So when it comes to this particular book, the novel follows four friends, Tess, Tazio, David, Angelica. And so what did you want to do with that gang of four and look at how they respond to one another?
Well, it was important to me that even though the novel might have been grounded somewhat in my own experience, I wanted to demonstrate the manner in which that experience affects others in those concentric circles, and not only the chronic health issue, but how each one of the main four characters have histories of betrayal or secrets that come to the surface based on a combination of David's illness and the current political moment after Trump's election. So my idea was, as somebody who had lived for all those years with that sort of invisible anxiety and pain, I wanted to show how each character's own trauma and experience affects not only themselves, but one another.
And ultimately, these are people just trying to make everything work out, make it not confusing, and be okay.
That's exactly right. I think so many novels that confront issues of health especially and trauma in general feel like they need to end with a bang. I mean, there are certainly scenes in my novel where there are moments of confrontation and sort of thrilling reversals and going into the past, but I didn't want the main character to end with either a miracle cure or death, as so many novels about or involving sick people do. I wanted to create a world where somebody could suffer in the beginning and maybe come to terms with the experience, but not necessarily have a solution at the end. And I think that goes not only for the character who has the physical ailments, but also for people who have been faced abuse in the past or sexual assault or, you know, what the other characters endure.
Was the 2016 election in writing this the perfect foil, or did it get in the way in some way?
I think that before the 2016 election, to write a political novel was an active decision, you know, that a novelist might make, where somebody would do some research and focus on the politics of the day or a different time. But in my experience after 2016, it almost feels like as active a decision to not write about politics. It's so much the air we all breathe and the context for all of our experience that to avoid Trump's election felt artificial to me. And as I was grappling with that decision, it came to my mind that it was such a perfect parallel to what I was going through. You know, in New York, where I live, the day after Donald Trump was elected, the entire town was sort of disoriented and confused in their sense of self and the world. They needed to recalibrate and try to figure out again. And I, who had been dealing with so many of those same emotions of confusion and uncertainty and fear and anxiety in my own mind, I saw it mapped out among everyone I knew. So it seemed like a great parallel to me that some people experience, you know, whether it's deceit or divorce or death or illness in their own life. And then the rest of America, whether they were excited or disappointed by the election results, were similarly going through a reorientation that I felt worked really well to situate the characters.
What was it about the timing, I guess, of with the illness? Did you have to have a firm grasp on it before you could write about it?
I think writing it helped me develop a firmer grasp on it. I mean, it's funny looking back. It was really 2.5 years, as I mentioned, a lot of which I was either bedridden or spending all my time trying to find doctors. And I don't remember a lot of those days. I mean, in thinking back about it now, I remember certain moments of acute suffering or doctor's appointments or disappointments, but a lot of just the ways I spent those days, I don't have access to. So I think that when I recovered enough to start writing, trying to articulate some of the emotions that I had felt but not been able to grasp and that I didn't fully remember the scenarios around was a great unburdening. I mean, I remember when I was at my worst, being furious at everyone. I was angry at the people who checked in all the time because I wanted to say, like, don't you see I'm suffering here? Like, yes, I'm still bad. You don't need to constantly ask because I'm chronically ill. But I was as angry with the people who weren't checking in. You know, I wanted to say, like, don't you realize I'm chronically ill? I think that there was an emotional need after getting through the worst of it to try to think through why I was so unable to talk about the worst of it while I was going through it. And it was such a wonderful opportunity to step outside myself and try to figure out, you know, what it was like for me and for all of us.
You wrote about this in a really incredible essay in the New York Times. And you say one of the problems for patients with dizziness is that doctors tend to be siloed into their own specialties by body part, eye, ear, brain. And this is in a piece that is titled Why Doctors Dismiss Dizziness. You went through all of that, right? I mean, it was one doctor after another.
I did. I went through probably 30 doctors in all, you know, half of which were traditional Western medicine with x-rays and psychopharmaceuticals, which is eventually where I ended up. But also I saw chiropractors and herbalists and dietitians and acupuncturists. And I feel like the problem with so many of these doctors is, and so many of these health practitioners in general, is they have their checklist, you know, where they go down a list and they say, well, this part of you works and this part of you works, so congrats, you're fine. It's probably just anxiety, or, you know, take a vacation or drink more water or something, because they are specialized to look into their individual areas and find the lesion or the problem. But with systemic problems like dizziness, where it's not just my ears, the inner ears that don't function, or my eyes or my brain, it's the system together. Similarly, if you ever speak with anybody who has Crohn's disease or irritable bowel syndrome, it's not the stomach that's at fault or the brain, but the whole system and the way everything works together. It's these disorders that I think lead to patients feeling as though they know their symptoms are real, but when they take the tests, the tests tend to come out negative, and that adds a then it's a psychiatric burden, you know, on top of the symptoms, and it gets really lonely. I mean, I received thousands of responses to this Times article from people just saying, like, thank you so much for validating my experience. I can't wait to show this to my blank. And then it was either my husband or wife or doctor or boss, because, you know, there are people whose lives can't be led in the same way, but who look completely healthy and who live in this world of invisible and undiagnosable illness.
Speaking of diagnosis, you were first diagnosed with vestibular migraine and then PPPD, which is persistent postural perceptual dizziness. Once you had that PPPD diagnosis, did anything change for you in the sense that you had a diagnosis, you had something to hang on?
Yes. So what changed was that I, at the Mayo Clinic, was slowly tapered off my medications that I had been on, which mitigated the symptoms somewhat, but not enough, and assigned a new set of medications. And people don't fully, even the experts in the field, don't fully understand what is wrong with my brain, why these medications mitigate the symptoms better, or why they lead to the side effects they do. But studies demonstrate they do. In researching that article, I spoke to so many, you know, putative experts in the field who all disagreed with one another about whether PPPD was a euphemistic diagnosis for people who don't want to be blamed for their own psychological issues, or whether it's the necessary diagnosis to cure these issues moving forward. It's so complicated, because not only at the ground level are all of these, you know, secondary practitioners, the ENTs and the neurologists, not working with one another for the most part to understand these disorders. But at the highest academic levels, people aren't using the same vocabulary. So you combine that with economic incentives of doctors really being incentivized to conduct tests for which they will be reimbursed, as opposed to taking the hours necessary to sit with a patient and really figure out what's going on. And it leaves, I think, hundreds of thousands of Americans silently suffering and unsure where to go.
The protagonist in your novel suffers many of the same symptoms that you suffer. And so, as we talked about, you write as a way to grapple and understand. There is a point where his wife asks if you're feeling better. Tell us about how you wrote that response and how ultimately you feel about that as to your future and how you live your life now.
Absolutely. I think that a very important realization I had when I was at the worst, and even when I started to feel better, but I still, you know, didn't have the few hours of clarity that I do now, where when someone asked me if I was feeling better, I would almost start to panic, because the idea, you know, I would check my symptoms, I would close one eye and then open it and then close the other, and if there was an imbalance there or if there was blurry vision, you know, the answer was like, no, I'm not feeling better, as though it was an all or nothing scale. Whereas what I began to come to terms with, and what I have the character try to articulate, is that, you know, maybe in terms of the physical body or the brain, I'm not feeling better, but I am, and David, the main character, towards the end of the novel, begins to try to feel better about the situation he's in, try to make the most of the moments when he is feeling better or when he has clarity, trying not to add that element of impotence and despair on top of the physical symptoms themselves. So not only is the process one where you try to find the right doctor and you try to get medicated and the symptoms, you know, decrease, but I do think that I was a little bit petulant for the first year or two of this, where I was almost hibernating until I could live again, you know, but that was the wrong way to see this. I wish I could have understood earlier on, if it was possible, that instead of putting everything on hold and just, you know, closing my eyes and waiting for it to be over, I allowed myself to take, even if it was just minutes of pleasure each day, and do my best to enjoy spending time with my wife and kids, even if I was a little bit off, as opposed to letting that frustration dominate my experience.
Because David says in the novel, I've been better at imagining the life I want to live. And you've gotten to that point.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, before this experience, I was never by disposition a grateful for every day kind of guy. But now just the ability to be alone with my kids, to enjoy time teaching again, to be able to have this conversation with you, it's a revelation. And I know that sounds, corny or too sincere, but I really do treasure parts of my life that I never slowed down to treasure before, which I think has been especially helpful in this moment of cultural chaos as well, where with the combination of a coronavirus or a political frustration or whatever it is, I feel like I am now psychologically better situated to cope than I probably would have been before all this pain.
Brian Platzer is the author of the new novel, The Body Politic. It is published by Atria. Brian, thank you so much for sharing time with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
It's always so fantastic. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you very much. Again, Brian Platzer is the author of the new book, The Body Politic. It is a novel published by Atria. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.